Okay, please come with me to the reading we had, Revelation 21. And if you remember, we've been saying the same thing week after week after week, that Revelation is a picture book. It's a series of overlapping pictures. It maps out the history of all things from before Christ's first coming to his second coming, his return to the last judgment, the new heavens and the new earth, and the endless ages to come. We've come in chapter 21, chapter 22. It's the climax of the book, and that's why the pictures at the end of the book are surpassingly wonderful. And John begins, doesn't he? Verse 1, "Now I saw," and we say, "Oh, John, what did you see? Tell us." "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea." The old order is gone forever. And with it, we've seen, has gone Babylon, the beast, the false prophet, and Satan, and all his works, and all those who have remained unchanged, unrepentant, unconverted, all have been cast into the lake of fire. We're told, verse 4, "For the former things have passed away." And he who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." And we ask the question, well, how new? And just today, one verse, verse 1, "A new heavens and," or "a new heaven and a new earth." "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea." Now listen to how Peter describes it. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. Peter says, "But the day of the Lord will come," this is the Lord's return, "as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." It's an awesome picture, isn't it? Think of it. We're told that the universe itself will be on fire, and the heavens at his word will pass away with a great noise. The old order is going. The old heavens and the earth are passing away. And with that, every possession, building, city, mountain, valley, continent, planet, every galaxy. I found today there are 5,000 million of them. That's galaxies, that is. They're still counting. The whole created order, says Peter, melting, dissolving, burning. Every trace of the fall, every mark of sin, it's cleansed, purged, purified by fire. And from the old will come a new heavens and a new earth, says Peter, where only righteousness dwells. How new is this new? Revelation 21, verse 1. Is it brand new? Well, there's a good Greek word for brand new, and it's not the word used here. The new here means much more a transformation. It's a rejuvenation of the old. Jesus in Matthew speaks of the regeneration. In Acts 3, Peter speaks of the restoration. In other words, this new heaven and new earth, it's a restored, renewed, remade, regenerated creation, swept clean forever from the marks of the curse. Now turn with me for a moment to Romans chapter 8. Verses 20 and 21. We're learning about the old creation, the one we're living in at the moment. Paul says, Romans 8, verse 20, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." To borrow an illustration, think of a play in which there's a great number of actors. And the many actors in this play depend upon the one, the principal actor. And guess what? On the first night, the opening night, the principal actor falls ill. Well, you can imagine, can't you? The play can't go on. And all the other actors who are in the play, but have lesser parts to play, they all feel utterly frustrated and redundant. What can we do now? What's the point? Why did I turn up? It's not what they would have chosen. And we're told here, verse 20, that when Adam sinned, when the principal actor, when the first man, when he sinned, the creation was subjected to futility. Not willingly. God did it. But that's not the end of the story. Subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected in hope. What are the cast of the play waiting for? They're waiting for the restoration of the lead actor, aren't they? When he's back in place, when he's there, when he's returned to full health and can be what he's supposed to be, when that happens, the play can go, can't it? The story can begin. And so verse 19, when the sons of God are revealed, verse 21, when the children of God come of age, when they're restored to full health, when there's the restoration of the people of God, then the creation, then all the other actors who are in this play will be set free, restored, regenerated. Because verse 21, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. So there's the old creation. But it's waiting for the restoration of the principal actor, the children of God. And when that's restored, then all the creation will play their part again as it was planned in the beginning. Now look at verse 22. It says, for we know that the whole creation groans and labours with birth pangs together until now. And what a groaning it is. Creation does groan, doesn't it? You know, a male lion will go and kill the cubs of his rival. You know, nice little lion cubs. Along comes the lion, beautiful mane, and with its teeth it'll break their necks. A wasp nest. You might think, well, not very keen on wasp nests, but they're a fantastic hive of activity, aren't they? Well, all the wasp nests are dead. By the end of autumn, they'll all died. Some of them contain tens, 20, 30,000 wasps. They all die. All that activity, all through the year, all through the summer. It's just dead, come to nothing. It's just a dead piece of paper, isn't it, really, now? We think of the blue tit. There's a pair, and they have, on average, 7 nestlings, 7 young. Okay, so there's the parents, and the 7, that makes 9. By the following spring, one of the parents will be dead, and 6 of the 7 will be dead. So 6 of those nestlings will have died by the spring. This is subject to futility, isn't it? Think of flowers, all their beauty and glory, and we cut them down, don't we? We stick them in a vase, and then they all wilt and wither, and that's the end of it. All their glory's gone. Everything's subjected to futility. We're told here in verse 22 that creation groans like a woman in labour. It cries out in pain. There's sorrow. But labour, of course, is not the end, is it? A woman in labour brings forth a child. And so this present groaning through which creation is going is not the end. It's not labouring for nothing, as it were. It all looks futile, but it won't be. Because this present creation will give birth to the new. There'll be a regeneration. A renewing, a remaking. It'll give birth to the new. And that's why this present creation is being personified, really, isn't it, in verse 19? It can't wait. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Oh, when that lead actor is back in the place where he should be, then all the rest of the cast can then do what they're supposed to do. It's waiting for that time. So do you see, it's a new heavens and a new earth, but when we're told about it, the new is not a brand new. You know, crisply minted in that sense. Not brand new, it's a regenerated heavens and earth, from which all traces of the curse and the fall have been erased forever. You can think of it another way. When Christ rose from the dead, was it the same body in which he died? It's not a trick question, right? Was it the same body in which he died?
Yes, sir.
Yes, it was. How do we know? The marks, that's right. Do you remember Thomas, isn't he? I mean, this is Thomas, you know, says, oh, I'm not going to believe you. You've got to be taken in by these things. I won't be taken in. And Jesus says to Thomas, reach your finger here and look at my hands and reach your hand here and put it in my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. So it is the same body in which he died, and yet it's gloriously renewed, isn't it? It's a resurrection body. It is the same, and yet it's not the same. But the wound prints are there. And the resurrection of his body is the first fruit of the full resurrection, which ultimately will embrace the whole universe. The whole universe is going to be resurrected. So everything's been subjected to the curse, so everything will be resurrected. And just as he bears the scars in a glorified body, so the new heavens and the new earth will in some way bear the scars of the fall. It's not brand new. But do his scars mar his body? They don't, do they? When we see the womb prints, they won't mar his glorified body. They'll add to the beauty of his glorified body. Because we'll see the womb prints and we'll say, well, he loved me and gave himself for me, won't we? And in the same way, whatever marks are left, whatever scars are left by the fall, they will only add to the beauty of the glorified universe. Wonderful, isn't it? Well, says John, as I looked, that day has come. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Do you ever stop and wonder and think about what it'll be like? Well, we'll pass a little bit more in a minute. But then it says this is rather curious, isn't it? And there was no more sea. I think, well, what's wrong with the sea? I rather like the sea. Why no more sea? Well, when God made the first heaven and the first earth, this present creation, what's the first thing he has to do to make it habitable for man? That's right. It's covered in water, isn't it? The whole thing is, the whole land surface is underwater. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. There's no land there. We can only live on land, can't we? If we go onto the water, we have to take land with us. We call them boats. We can't live in the water. The whole thing's covered in water. And more than that, isn't it? It's something very threatening, isn't it? There's a sort of great primeval chaos. The water's covering the world. And then God imposes his will upon the waters, doesn't he? He says, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. The waters above, the waters below. And then he goes on, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And God brings order out of the chaos. He forces his will upon the creation. If you like, he's asserting his kingship. He's the king. He speaks. It obeys. And the waters are driven back. Okay, they've pushed back to their boundaries. But the ocean, although it's pushed back into its boundaries, it remains something terrifying, something threatening. It might at any moment pour over its boundaries and come back and cover the earth again, mightn't it? It's like a wild dog, untrained dog, and God, as it were, puts it on a chain. Says, you stay there. Don't move. Don't you dare break your chain. But you have a sense this wild dog at any moment could break its chains and come back again, couldn't you? That's the sense of it. And of course it does, isn't it? When does it break its chains and come back again? Tsunami, yes, there's a classic illustration. And you can get even bigger than that. The flood is the ultimate, isn't it? Where it broke its chains. The dog came back again. Broke its boundaries and covered the earth. And it came close to destroying the whole human race, didn't it? Nearly everybody was killed. There's only those who were in a boat, the ark, the eight, who were saved. But then again, God asserts his kingship and drives the waters back. his authority. He reestablishes the order, and God saves his people. So the sea is something chaotic, it's terrifying, it's all the time threatening man's existence. But it's more than that as well, because after the fall, the sea becomes identified with Satan. Now, when I say Loch Ness, what comes to people's mind is the monster, you know, the Loch Ness monster. And in Job, you may remember, you read of this colossal sea monster. Anyone remember what it's called? Leviathan, that's right. And it's God shows him Leviathan and says, well, look, I made Leviathan. Have you ever seen anything like this, Job? And you're wanting to pick an argument with me, Job. Leviathan, king of the deep. And so if you think of Loch Ness, you think of the monster. Okay? When you think of the ocean, in this is the language of the Bible, using the Bible's terms of reference, when you think of the oceans, the seas, you think of Leviathan. So when Israel crossed the Red Sea, it's spoken in terms of defeating Leviathan. So Psalm 74 says, you divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces. So when Israel crossed the Red Sea, okay, it was a sea, but because in the language, the symbols of the Bible, it's also spoken of defeating Leviathan, the king of the sea, this great sea monster. Okay? But Leviathan, as you go through the Bible, this creature becomes identified with another monster. It's a monster we've been looking at as we've been going through Revelation. And that monster is Satan himself. So, for example, Isaiah 27:1, we read, in that day the Lord with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, that twisted serpent. He will slay the reptile that is in the sea. He's talking about Leviathan, this sea monster, but he's using language talking about a serpent. Isaiah 51. I need to turn to it. I'll just read it. Isaiah 51, are you not the one who dried up the sea, talking about the crossing of the Red Sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? Sorry, I turned to the wrong one here. Where was it? Oh, sorry, it's the verse before. Sorry, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake, as in the ancient of days and the generations of old, are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent? Are you not the one who dried up the sea? And so on. So, when God divided the sea, it's spoken of in one breath as saying he cut Leviathan in half, or he destroyed this great sea monster, but actually, in the language and the internal reasoning of the Bible, Leviathan is also identified with Satan. When God divided the sea, he was also defeating Satan. And of course, that's the case, isn't it? You think of the children of Israel. They've come out of Egypt. They're to be redeemed, aren't they? It's redemption. They're coming out of Egypt. They've escaped from Egypt. They're the people of God. They're going to the promised land. But they hit what seems to be an impossible obstacle. They've got their backs to the sea. They've got Pharaoh and all his armies pursuing them. It looks like it's going to be a slaughter. They're hemmed in. They can't go anywhere. Satan has got the people of God. They can't escape until God parts the Red Sea and they're able to cross it on dry land. And in the language of the Bible, it's saying it wasn't just a case of, you know, don't just think of sort of a military fight or a great miracle which saved them from Egypt. What was going on was a far greater canvas. This was God overthrowing Satan to bring his people out of Egypt and into the promised land. Okay? He's defeating Satan. So do you see? So the sea not only speaks of the threatening chaos which made this world uninhabitable, the sea also comes to represent the activity of Satan, blocking the path of God's people to the promised land. That's why in Revelation, again, you have language that talks of the sea. It talks about the dragon stands by the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. The dragon, Satan, calls a beast out of the sea. Revelation 13. It's the Roman beast coming out of the sea. It's coming out of symbolic sea, out of the nations. It's also coming out of a literal sea, because the readers are from Asia Minor, and across the sea will come the persecuting Roman beast. So now do you understand the wonder of why it says, and there was no more sea? It's gathering up into its skirts all the symbolism of sea in the Bible. It's saying, look, this new heaven and new earth is to be the home of the people of God forever. And there's no sea there. There's nothing to threaten our peace. There's no swirling, threatening chaos just beyond the borders that at any moment could wash over us and destroy us as it did in the flood. It won't be like that. It'll be peace. It'll be home. It'll be rest. You'll have nothing to fear. And not just that symbolism, but there'll be no Satan. There'll be no monster. There'll be no dragon. There'll be no Leviathan threatening, assaulting, trying to block our way. We've reached the everlasting rest of the promised land. We never have to worry or be troubled or fear or just check everything's all right or get the weather forecast or anything like that ever again. We're home. It's rest. No one's going to throw us out. No one's going to take us away. Satan and all his works have gone and gone and gone forever. So no sea. So a new heavens and a new earth. And you'll see, verse 2, a new Jerusalem. Then I, John, saw the holy city, new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So the holy city is called the new Jerusalem. And the new Jerusalem is the very same as the bride, adorned for her husband. So the new Jerusalem is, of course, the church. It's the bride of Christ, the people of God. And that's where we must leave it for now. We'll come back. But do you see? When God created the first heaven and earth, only when it was ready did he make man. And he brought him into a garden paradise. And now only when all is ready, he's made a new heaven and a new earth. Only when all is ready, only when our eternal home has been prepared to perfection, only then, as it were, does the Lord carry his bride across the threshold and say it's home. This is where we're going to live together forever. The meek shall inherit the earth. Said Jesus. So Christian, there's a new heaven and a new earth. What do you think of this creation? Aren't there moments when there's breathtaking beauty and wonder, isn't there? And we're overwhelmed by what we see. And everything inside us says, hold on to it, hold on to it. And sometimes it's where you almost wish you could just sort of get your arms around it and put it somewhere that you just keep on looking at it or keep it. But it never lasts, does it? You see a rainbow and you say, oh, have you seen that? Quick, quick, quick. Or maybe there's a beautiful bird that lands in the garden or something and you call someone to see it quickly before it flies away. Or there's a sunset and you've got to catch it because in a minute or two's time it'll have changed. Everything is changing. Everything is decaying. Everything's not as it was. We want to hold on to the moment, but the moment always passes. But what will it be like in that new heaven and new earth to gaze on perfection forever and with undimmed, unwearied eye just to be overwhelmed and amazed at the glory and the wonder? We'll never grow tired of looking at new horizons, new glories, new wonders of the new heaven and the new earth. And Christian friends, a new heaven and a new earth. You may feel this is a bit odd, but I'm going to say it. Aren't there moments when you felt this creation stir? You've been somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, and you've been, I know, close to nature, in the creation. And you felt that it was stirring, that it was capable of something altogether more glorious than what you see. And yet, it can never break its chains, can it? is subjected to futility. You feel there should be more, but it never seems to come to anything. You may know Prince Caspian, the second book in the Chronicles of Narnia. And Lucy's returned to Narnia, and she remembers the days when the trees could talk, and as it were, they were alive. And she comes into a clearing. It's in the night, and there's moonlight. And she's surrounded by trees, and she says, "Oh, trees, trees, trees. Oh, trees, wake, wake, wake." And it says, "Though there was not a breath of wind, they all stirred about her. The rustling noise of the leaves was almost like words. The nightingale stopped singing, as if to listen to it." Lucy felt that at any moment she would begin to understand what the trees were trying to say. But the moment did not come. The rustling died away. The nightingale resumed its song. And it's obviously a story, but it's not strange to us, is it? You see, we were created, weren't we, to rule over the works of God's hands. It's in us. That was where it's spoiled, it's corrupted, it's been distorted, but it's been in us. God put it in us to rule over the works of his hands. We were created so that the creation, in fact, would stir at our voice. But it doesn't. It's in bondage. And yet it waits. It waits. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. So what will it be like on that day when the chains are broken and it will again hear the voice of the children of God? As it says in Isaiah, "For you shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace, and the mountains and the hills will break forth into singing before you, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands." They will wake. The chains will have gone. The creation will be restored. A new heavens and a new earth. And this present creation is like a faded sepia photograph, isn't it, compared to the new creation that's coming. The futility, the corruption, the groaning which Paul is speaking about, the curse, it's all the result of the curse. The day is coming when it'll be gone forever. And I will see what a lion is really supposed to be like. In that new heaven and new earth, there'll be the real lions. And we'll see what the lions here were, little scrawny lions compared to the real ones. And I'll see what colour is really supposed to be. And I'll look at the colour and beauty of the real flowers. And I'll smell a scent that I've never, ever smelt in this world. Wonderful. And we have pets, don't we? You may have, for example, a pet dog. And it's not a wild dog, is it? It doesn't run with the pack. It's obedient to a point. And at times you say about your dog, well, it's almost human. Because under your headship, okay, you're the crown of creation, you're a child of God, under your headship, that dog reflects something of your image. It's under your feet to a measure. But what would it be like on that day when all creation will be put under the feet of the children of God? When everything in creation will bear something of our image? When everything in creation will, if you like, have something human about it? Reflecting, bearing our image. All will be tame. In that sense. And again, the language of Isaiah. You know, we're not making these things up. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. The young ones shall lie down together. And the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole. And the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Yet, of course, that lion won't be a cuddly toy lion, will it? It'll be tame. But because it'll be a real lion, it will have a majesty and a wonder, which will make me, I don't know if I'll be afraid in that world, but there'll be something of the awe of what a real lion is like, because that's what it is. We won't be looking over our shoulders at the threatening sea. We won't be wondering, well, is this going to last? Is something going to come and spoil it? Is Satan going to come and destroy and mar? This really will be forever. Now, Christian friends, as we come to Revelation 21, we're entering a palace. We've really only got to the first room. And we've actually just walked up just to one little tiny bit of the wall of the first room. We said, well, just look at that picture there, and look at that picture there, and look at that picture there, and think about these things. Go away and think about them. But we've only got to the first room. There are more rooms in this chapter which we're going to get to. And at the centre of the palace, there's the most wonderful room of all. We've only got to the first room. What's that? What are the other rooms like? And what's the room like that's right at the heart of the palace? But what's the application of all of this? It's simply this. Sometimes, Christian friends, it's all right to feel good, to feel thrilled at being a Christian. Just to think about where we're going. Just to think about what the future holds. Just to think about the new heavens and the new earth and all that God has prepared. Just to feel this is wonderful. This is good. This is thrilling. And just to think about it. Just to be thrilled at being a Christian. To think I really do matter. God's preparing a home. He really does love me. Love me. And it's never entered my head yet. Just the things he has prepared for me. And I'm going to glory. That's my home. That's where I belong. The more I think about it, the more I contemplate it, the more I'll be thinking, Lord, I can't wait.